All right. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Good morning, good morning. You are listening to the very first installment of The Crazy Libertarian. I am your host, the Crazy Libertarian himself, Bradley Foster. I've been on The Policy, if you've been unfortunate enough to hear that show a couple times previously. I've been a guest, and they liked me so much that they decided to bring me back as a full-time contributor. So I'll be bugging you on your Wednesday mornings from here on out. Very happy to have you along with me. Now, I am obviously on 88.1 FM, proudly serving the Fargo-Moorhead area. The call-in number is 701-566-0917. So, I'm going to start this a little bit differently than most shows do. And I really want to start with a story of a friend of mine. Now, I'm changing some names and some details for privacy and all that stuff. But my friend's name is Jeff, and my friend Jeff, like a lot of people, has suffered from very, very bad depression, anxiety, a whole host of mental issues. Now, Jeff has been struggling with this for his entire life. From middle school, high school, he tried counseling, he tried over-the-counter, he tried prescriptions, and nothing seemed to work for him. However, what Jeff did have was hope and a drive to attempt to make himself feel better. He once said to me that ever since the day that he realized that he almost didn't want to be alive, he wanted to, in a weird way, it drove him to fix that. So Jeff, after doing some research online, after tons and tons and tons of dead ends, I mean, there were so many treatments that were supposed to help, and then if anything would make them worse, it would be a very expensive placebo. So Jeff, after doing some research and reading online, found a number of articles that said that in certain conditions, certain people with treatment-resistant depression and other diseases like anxiety, PTSD, can benefit from therapies like psilocybin mushrooms. Psilocybin, which is currently a Schedule I drug in the United States, with only a few studies being done on it, less than 50 people in this country, certainly less than 100 have seen this test done on them. But the information that we do have, and that Jeff had, largely came out of the United Kingdom, where one study reported that of a dozen people that went in for who all had treatment-resistant depression, the other medications were not working for them. 12 people went in. They took 2 doses of psilocybin. One dose was a low dose just to make sure that they didn't have any reactions. The second dose was, I believe, 2.5 grams, which is a sizable dose of psilocybin. Now, mind you, this is the first study that's been done on this for almost 50 years, because the United States government has pushed not only its local and subordinate state governments to prohibit this, but also the international community through the International Convention on Narcotic Drugs. They've made it very, very hard and impossible and demonized to schedule these things, or to research these things. So this study showed that of the 12 people that went on, something like 2/3 of them saw long-lasting, immediate improvement. As a matter of fact, of those that saw improvement, 80% of them saw that improvement at 6 months past the treatment date with one active dose session. What's even more interesting about this is that most of these people, actually all of these people, said that because it was handled in a safe way, they were in a safe set, in a safe setting, none of them had negative side effects. So, admittedly, a small-scale study, but you see a dozen people, and doing the math, there are, what, 8 of them come out with significantly reduced depression for at least a period of time? Jeff said, why not? So, he got 2 grams of magic mushrooms, psilocybin, if you will. He got a friend to sit him. He took it, and in his words, stared at a wall in 5 hours. And while I don't want to go too much into detail, he said that he really asked some questions that he'd never been able to because of the psilocybin. And when he came out a couple days later, he started noticing that the effect that he was feeling wasn't just some residual afterglow, if you will. It was sustained improvement. And since then, Jeff has been able to, he's been doing way better mentally. He finished out his academic career strong. He's having professional success. All these things that would have never been possible, at least in his own words, were it not for the psilocybin. So with that, I kind of want to use it as a launching point, because there's a lot of stuff tangled up there, right? We have talks about mental health, a drug policy. This doesn't even begin to cover the wars that we've been funding for the last 2-3 to 4 decades now, where we have troops that are coming home with ever-increasing amounts of PTSD, depression, and anxiety, and ever-shrinking amounts of support. So the question becomes, what has the government's role been in all this? And here's the thing, Jeff is just one person. There are thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people out there who deal with very severe mental illnesses. And at least with the research that we've been allowed to do, because the governments have occasionally granted an exception, we're seeing massive benefits. Now, the thing that's enraging about this is that this is not the first time that this has come up. We've known about this in some circles for the better part of 50 years. We had the Harvin psilocybin trials. We had research done in the late 50s and early 60s that showed that psilocybin, LSD, and other drugs of that nature could have huge impacts for psychotherapy, for treating alcoholism, treating depression, treating insomnia, all kinds of things, and with minimal side effects. However, once the counterculture really caught on to LSD, and a man named Richard Nixon, although he wasn't the only one, but, you know, he was the big guy, he's going to make a cameo appearance later in our show, by the way. It's special. So he came out and launched this, you know, hideous war on drugs. And one of the side effects of that war on drugs has been that these misunderstood compounds, MDMA, which has shown great use for potential PTSD treatments, psilocybin, LSD, have been improperly demonized and kind of and placed up there. Actually, they're scheduled beyond meth and cocaine. LSD and psilocybin are Schedule 1. Meth and cocaine, if you can believe it or not, are Schedule 2. You can actually get a meth prescription. It's called Desioxin. And so the crazy thing about this is that if you're listening to those who say that, you know, the reason that the government has needed to expand in the last century, the reason that it's needed to become more involved in our lives, the reason that it needs to do things like police us from ourselves and engage in a Fourth Amendment shredding and trillion-dollar deficit creating war on drugs, and the reason that it needs to go and interfere in the Middle East and in other countries with American lives and American dollars is supposedly for our benefit, right? Supposedly to make us safer, to make us richer, to make us better. But in the story that I just mentioned, everything that the government did and every role that the government's been playing has made it harder to do so. And this doesn't even get into, by the way, the war on drugs on a broader level, and how that has done things like tear apart inner city families, tear apart communities, send people who otherwise would have been law-abiding citizens to prisons. Horrible things, which, by the way, if we're speaking on the mental health, are all horrible for it. So I guess I just want to kind of start off with that and kind of bring up how, for lack of a better term, the government has been taking from you, taking from us, lying to us, and then making us worse off because of it. And this is going to be a reoccurring theme. There's going to be a few things that I'm really going to talk about. Kind of three central pillars that I'll come back to again and again. And the first thing that I want to do on this show is I want to get people thinking a little more, I guess you could say, critically. You know, there's a lot in the media that is just, I mean, other than being blatantly false and then only being corrected with a small amount in the back section of a major newspaper, is just so, so, so selfish and so obviously partisan and so biased. And to be honest with you, the bigger issue, and I would argue it's been a bigger issue for longer, is that this mindset is already in the government. So one of the things I'm really going to be talking about on this show is why it's important for every individual that's listening or not listening, all of us out there, to use what's between our ears. Use your critical thinking. I'm really going to challenge people, because when horrible things happen, it's not because a bunch of people are horrible. It's because a bunch of good people don't use their reasoning, they don't use their hearts, and they let terrible, terrible outcomes come to pass. The second thing that I'm going to go on and on about, I think I've been on The Policy, a show hosted by Raheem Williams and Jamal Omar, 3 times, and I've probably talked about this subject on there about 12 times. So, you know, I'm down for it, is the war on drugs. It's, if there's anything that I think kind of proves my point and proves the larger classical liberal notion on government, it's the results that we're beginning to see from the war on drugs. you know, 50 years ago when we were stuck in the Vietnam quagmire, we had protests in almost every major city out in the streets protesting. And over the course of the war, we lost about 60,000 troops dead. I mean, more casualties than that, but that was the total amount dead. Last year, or at least in 2017, the last year for which research statistics are available, 70,000 people died from opioid overdoses. That's more people than died in the entire Vietnam War. So that's something that I really want to talk about, and I'm going to keep bringing up again and again and again, because I don't think that this crisis, that, by the way, is government created, they're making it worse with every step that the federal government takes, seemingly, and no one's really paying attention. It's, you know, they call it the silent epidemic, and I know by this point people have heard about it, but, you know, people don't think about what 70,000 people looks like. Imagine a third of the Fargo-Moorhead community wiped out like that. That's 70,000 people every single year. And this doesn't mention the other injustices that are perpetrated because of this. This doesn't mention the kids who are continuing to have seizures because medical marijuana is either illegal or very hard to get in their state. This doesn't mention the people that are being locked up because they have a plant that the government doesn't like on them. This doesn't even mention the people that dare to challenge the authority and attempt to treat a lifelong mental health condition with a forbidden substance. This is just talking about those 70,000 people. Let's break it down to that little section for a moment. What protests have we had? I know that we've seen a lot of protests against Trump in the White House, and I know that we've heard a lot of stuff about punishing the pharmaceutical companies that did that, and they certainly played their role. But there's a larger issue here. The larger issue is that we as a country have switched from having a prescription pill crisis to a heroin crisis to a fentanyl crisis that, God, if we can stop it before it goes to carfentanil, which is 50 times stronger than fentanyl. Fentanyl, by the way, being 50 times stronger than heroin. And so we're talking about very, very, very powerful substances are becoming the norm. I was reading a great book called Fentanyl Inc., I forget exactly who the author is. My apologies. I'll mention it I'll put it online somewhere to give that guy his due credit. But and it mentioned the story of how this one user, because of our failed drug policies, was using fentanyl up to 30 times a day to get that high that they needed. Nothing that the federal government has done since this process has come up has done anything to quell the numbers. As a matter of fact, the people that are being punished are those who are using prescriptions legally for chronic pain conditions. So that's just one thing that I want to talk about. And I think what's really important, and I want to save some space for our first guest later on as well to talk on the subject, but I just want to reiterate how little sense this failure that prohibition has been. And I want to reiterate that even if my ideas aren't right, we seriously need to start holding our elected leaders accountable, and we need to start demanding change, because people will continue to die. It will continue to be those people who are in the shadows, and we will see more people die from fentanyl and other related opioids unless we fix this crisis. And the last thing that I'm really going to ramble on about is what I like to is the military-industrial complex. You know, the neocon, the neoliberals. We need to destabilize countries in order to stabilize them nonsense. And you know, this is all, at least when I plan this out, is all sort of tied together. But I kind of just want to once again point out how little the average American has benefited for the last 20 years of American interference in the Middle East. What have we gotten out of it? What positive has there been since 9/11 for the United States? Absolutely nothing. Did we make it worse? Yes. Did we learn absolutely any lessons from our time in the Middle East? God, no. Because not, you know, 15 years after 9/11, which was a bunch of guys that we had armed that later turned out to not be our friends, we somehow stumbled into the Middle East and helped create ISIS, which we are now still dealing with, and we are now still having to pay, both in American blood and in American treasures, to fight. So my lesson here is that, or I guess what I'd like to bring up, is that we really need to radically rethink not only America's role in the Middle East, but also our military strategy in general. Because this idea that we're going to go police the entire world with our great big land army simply isn't working, and the effects that we're having on our local, on not only our economies and our troops and also those people in the Middle East is horrendous. I don't know if we've seen, and I've talked to plenty of veterans, I don't know how many veterans you would meet today that would say going into Iraq was a good idea. I don't know how many senators you can find that voted to go in Iraq, for that matter, that would say that going into Iraq was the right idea. And yet we continue to buy into this collective myth that every problem in the Middle East is somehow an American problem. Some of these things simply aren't our concern, and as a result of getting concerned with business that isn't ours, we have continued to bleed trillions and continue to send thousands of our best men and women to early graves. This is simply not right, and almost no one's commenting on it. You know, we had that troop withdrawal where like 100 troops were pushed out of a region in northern Syria, and everyone was acting like that was the end of the world. My goodness, we have like, I don't forget the exact numbers, but we have 5 figures of troops in Syria right now. We have 5 figures of troops. Not to mention the rest of, that are stationed across, Trump recently deployed more to Saudi Arabia, not to mention those that are stationed in Afghanistan still, not to mention those that are stationed in Germany and South Korea and Japan. This is all coming from our pockets, and this is all, and you have to wonder collectively how much of this is actively making America safer. After what we've learned in the last 20 years, is military adventurism really in our best interest? After what we've learned in the last 20 years, how many more veterans do we need to see commit suicide before we say, first off, maybe we should reestablish whether this is all worth it, and second off, why are we not giving them the proper treatment that they need to address these things? One of those, by the way, could be MDMA. There was a group called MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Sciences, that did a study that had a one member claim, if I recall correctly, that MDMA was like a miracle cure for his PTSD. Why on earth is MDMA still a Schedule I substance? Why on earth are we sending our troops to die and then having the gall? You know what? Let's even forget the scary sounding stuff, right? Let's talk about just medical marijuana, pot. Even the people that are against it say it's harmless, it won't ruin your life. Federally, these people still can't get medical marijuana. Why? Why shouldn't the federal government be giving them an inexpensive and profoundly effective treatment because of some outdated science? What the hell is going on here? And why has this been going on for so long, by the way? These are the things that I really want people to start to question. Because this is really, really all important stuff. And like I said, it's all sort of interconnected. But the general basis that I have here is that each and every one of you are paying for this. Our national deficits, or our national debt, is over $22 trillion. It's going up every single day. Trump, who said that he would eliminate the national debt in the first 8 years in office, is on pace to add more than $1 trillion this year. Eventually, this math isn't going to add up. And here's the thing. It's not like there's one, some people have pointed to what they call the deep state. Some people have pointed to, some people still unironically believe in the Illuminati and all that stuff. But the scary thing is that there's not one lie, or there's not one group that's tricking people. There's a lot of people that have figured out how to use the influence of the government to make a lot of money for themselves at the expense of most of the people who are listening to this right now. People like you and me, people who are middle class, who go along with it, not to mention the lower class, and they figured out effectively how to turn whatever form of capitalism we had in this country into a cronyist game like it's never been. That's what they do with the prison industrial complex. That's what they do with the military industrial complex. They say that there's an old quote that every war is a banker's war. And increasingly, while that might not, be specifically related to banking anymore, that is true. Whenever the government takes an action to either prohibit something or to go against a group of people, it's imperative on all of us to really ask ourselves, what are we getting out of this? What are my children getting out of this? What is the breakdown for the whole country? because for the last 50 years, we've had a lot of people who have done or who have just kind of gone along with it because they see benefits in one way or another, and the situation is kind of snowballed. And honestly, I don't know how much longer we have to really be able to stop it. How much longer until we end up with runaway inflation like Weimar Germany, or how much longer until we have to have severe austerity cuts, severe cuts to Social Security and Medicaid immediately, not because of, you know, some evil plan to hurt the poor, but because we run out of money and end up like Greece. This is a lot to throw at people. I get that. But the broader point that I really want to circle back to is that, you know, if we're going to, I'm going to steal a line from the grand narcissist himself, if we're going to make America great again, we need to make America critical again. We should be questioning every authority because following it hasn't worked out so well for us, I would argue. As a matter of fact, as someone from, you know, middle class means with coming from a working family, my mom did daycare for like 30 years, still does. My stepdad worked in a paper company or paper mill for 30 years. My dad ran his own small businesses. What have we really gotten out of it? Except for maybe an underperforming Social Security program that might be there for some of us. A failing public education system. Where's the benefit been? Hey there, folks. Welcome back to The Crazy Libertarian. This is your host, Bradley Foster. Always crazy, always libertarian. And with me, I have a very special guest, and it is
Taylor Bankston, not a crazy libertarian, but really excited about harm reduction.
Harm reduction, all right. Well, why don't you tell the good people a little bit about yourself, Taylor?
Yeah, so I'm currently a pharmacy student at North Dakota State University, halfway through the program, going strong. And I lead a group on campus called Students for Sensible Drug Policy. So what we do is we talk about policy reformation, we talk about harm reduction, and basically trying to break down the stereotypes of people having stigmas about people who use drugs. Obviously, we don't advocate people like they should or shouldn't use drugs, but if they choose to, I personally think they should be safe about it, not only for themselves, but on a community-based stance.
Okay, so kind of talking about, you know, that's a lot right there, talking about, let's start with harm reduction.
Yeah.
I guess the best way to ask this is two-part question. First off, what do you really, like, what are the central tenets of harm reduction? What does that actually look like?
So for me, it's availability to any sort of, so I focus on harm reduction with addiction or any sort of substance use. So I'm an advocate for needle exchanges. So if you're using, you should be using safely. I know different pharmacies in our community that sell clean syringes and you can just buy them like over the counter, but that's because they want it to be available so you're not reusing needles or sharing needles and just keeping like infections and transmissible diseases down. So like if you're like a needle user, it would be something like that. Otherwise, it would just be education. I think one of the biggest things about harm reduction is knowing what's going on and how to help people in a situation where maybe they might have OD'd or anything like that. So just being knowledgeable about what's going on around you.
Mm-hmm. Kind of moving beyond the paradigm that was set for decades now in the 80s of just say no.
Yeah.
Or, you know, all drug use is bad, all drug use is frowned upon, all of that good stuff. So when you talk about information, you know, you're out there talking to students, weekly, monthly, however often you guys do your things. What are some of the things that you've, I guess, what do you see the biggest need for? Or when you're talking, what's the things that you're like, what are the things that people are either misinformed about or that, you know what I mean? Where are some of those errors in kind of our thinking on the subject?
Sure, sure. I think the biggest thing is the misconception that anyone who uses drugs basically has no positive impact in our community. So just because I held a sign that said legalize marijuana ? I've been called stoner girl multiple times just walking around campus. Have they ever seen me do drugs? No. Have I? No. Like it doesn't matter. And I get really angry about the stigma of it. So I'd say biggest thing is misconceptions. just kind of not forming your own opinion and doing whatever the school and systems taught you, like DARE. Because as we know with alcohol, prohibition doesn't work. So we need to have a different like outlook on how to treat not only harm reduction stance, but stigmas and just stereotyping people in general. So,
okay, one of the things that you brought up there at the end is kind of the model that prohibition doesn't work. Mm-hmm. As we sip our perfectly legal, perfectly dangerous, and large amounts drug of choice, caffeine, live on air, because you can take some risks with your body in this country, apparently.
Yeah.
So I kind of want to go back with you a little bit and sort of talk about, because whenever we talk about this, like, war on drugs, it's, I mean, especially for our generation, it's the default, right? Like, we grew up with, I don't know about you, but I remember, like, when I was a little fourth grader at a private Christian school, they'd bring in, like, a little bit of the, like, just this horrible weed that, you know, they ruin some kid's life over, and they bring it in the school, and they're like, that's what that looks like, so avoid it, and, you know, the fear and the... I will maintain, I am still mad at the lack of people in all denim outfits that have offered me joints. The 90, my school promised me that would be a thing I'd have to deal with, and that, none. No, I'll catch it on Snapchat for you guys. It hasn't happened yet.
It's too expensive.
It's just, it's ridiculous. But, so I kind of want to talk about a little bit of that history.
Sure.
Now, you know, we talk about prohibition in this country. We talk about the 1920s, of course, where it starts to get interesting for those of us who are fighting the modern prohibitions in the 1970s. You had Nixon and the counterculture. I sort of want to go to, let's place the year at 1962, way back there. Now, let's talk about, you know, before this craziness, this, and we had certain aspects of the war on drugs by then, but before it really got off to a fever pitch, some of the, like, research that was out back then.
The research that's not going on anymore because it's all criminalized?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, if you think about, I don't know, do you listen to the Grateful Dead?
Way more than I should admit on air.
So they were playing for, like, basically for the government, and they were, like, doing different testings on drugs and psychedelics, and they needed a band that could play for an insane amount of time, enough time to really, like, look at these subjects. And then there's so much, like, political changes, and there's so much, like, you know, maybe we shouldn't do this, and that's fine. But then they, like, turned on the band, started, like, arresting them for drug use, and it's just, like, messed up in general. But basically, it's just a lot of it, because you hear about with, like, cannabis and how there's been regulations on it because of, like, cultural differences or discrimination in immigration. So you look at it from all these different points, like, you don't really hear about, oh, we're prohibiting these things because of how it's impacting your body. You know what I mean? They basically just say anyone who uses is bad. Anyone who makes these decisions are lowlifes, and they don't, like, have this right to be doing this. I don't know if that makes sense, but
yeah, which is, and that's exactly what Nixon wanted to do. We have evidence from his top narcotics assistant at that point, who pretty much came out and said, yeah, we knew we were lying about the heroin and the weed and LSD, but we wanted to make blacks who were protesting for civil rights and hippies who were protesting to an end in the war in Vietnam look very bad. And an easy way to do that is to link certain substances as criminal.
Yeah.
Bada bing, bada boom. One of the things that we love emphasizing here on the Crazy Libertarian is that short-term actions by the government are only seen in a short-term one-to-one ratio, right? It's only what happens and what is allegedly going to happen immediately afterwards.
Yeah.
We never had this discussion with the war on drugs. There was one poll, I think it was taken in like 1981 or two, right when Reaganomics is at its peak. And it said something like 84% of Americans considered illegal drug use to be the number one problem in America. And of course, that's when we took what Nixon did and expanded upon it in the 80s. You have things like mandatory minimums that come up. You have civil asset forfeiture. You have the militarization of the police. Do you know the amount of Americans the next year, that the very next year, before a lot of these programs had really started to, like, take root, that said drug use was the number one problem in America? 19%. So it hasn't crossed 25% since then annually. Like, we have the research on this. It's one of the last, oddly enough, it's always second to things like the economy, blah, blah, blah. But so you have a very short-sighted goal with horrible long-term implications that if the people understood at the time what would happen, they certainly didn't care about, yeah, that trap people like you and me. So I kind of want to, you know, the president of Students for Sensible Drug Policy on campus, giving a voice to those rabble-rousing young people.
Yeah.
When you think of the harms of prohibition, do you know of any personal examples or any stories that you can think of, whether you've met the people or not, or you've heard them through the grapevine, of how, like, you know, even getting caught once can just throw your life off track?
Sure, absolutely. So I have a friend who's actually going to be speaking with their group the end of this month, the end of November, and he struggled a lot with the system, basically. So he got caught once, and then basically he lost his job. Like, there was no sense of empathy. Like, oh, you're suffering with this chronic addiction. Like, sorry, like, that really sucks for you, doesn't it? And so he lost, like, everything about it. And he, like, from then on out, had all these different problems with, like, the criminal justice system and just the way they treated him as a person because of the decisions they felt were wrong. But they didn't look at the other side of it of, like, oh, why is he using? Oh, how can we help him? You know what I mean? There was no support at all. So for him, after that, he just, like, I think, I shouldn't say for him specifically, but a lot of people will go in a downward spiral. And there's so many different prison systems and jails where people want to stay in there because on the outside world, like where we are right now, it's different. People are going to shun you. They're going to be like, oh, they're bad people. They really messed up a lot. But it's just not good. I've talked with a couple people, with family members who are in some sort of prison system for drug use. And basically, they're like, they don't even want to try. There's no form of, like, reformation, re-education, anything like that, rehabilitation. Throw any re you want. It's not there. They say it is, but there's also no drive for it because without having these different, like, steps into place of this is how you can change and this is how you can make different decisions, it doesn't matter because it's not implemented. People just don't want to come out.
Yep. And so that's a, you know, and it's crazy because the reason that drugs are illegal in the first place, right, is allegedly for, like, public health and because it'd do all these bad things to society and blah, 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 blah. But then if, yes, my 300 milligrams of caffeine.
It's cardiovascular disease in a can, basically.
Gotta love it.
Yeah.
But yet when we, and it's so ridiculous, the thinking that we're going to criminalize this type of behavior in the first place, right? Because, I mean, obviously, in that case, and I'm sure that everyone listening, whether you know that person or not, has known one person that's got, or whether you know that that person has gone through it or not, knows at least one person that's got tripped up in the criminal justice system. Maybe they made a mistake, they went through a dark period, they had some trauma that they attempted to deal with, whatever it may be. These programs that we've put in place aren't helping those people.
No.
These programs that we've put in place are making it actively worse for them, which is where it kind of comes up with the notion that, and you know, we're obviously, whenever I bring a guest on my show, I'm probably not going to agree with them 100% of the time.
Oh, yeah.
There is a reason that I titled my show The Crazy Libertarian, both of those crazy and libertarian capitalized. But the point that I really want to bring on this show time and time and time again is that we need to start thinking critically about some of these major societal problems. I mentioned it earlier in the night before my guest came on. Last year, we had something like 70,000 people died due to drug overdoses in this country last year, which is more than we lost in the entire Vietnam War. Something very clearly needs to change. Now, I obviously have quite strongly fastened my opinions to the free market and blah, 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 blah. But the point is, whichever direction we end up going, we need to start asking the difficult questions and looking at the cold realities. Because the fact of the matter is, when you have a system in which I think it's like 82% of inmates end up recommitting, the recidivism rate is like 82% right now, these things just aren't working. However, and while this is not my perfect end-all be-all, do you know what apparently has worked very well in kind of stopping the scourge, as I'm sure you can tell us more about, is the Portugal program. Excuse me, folks, that was very poorly timed.
Sorry.
Laughter abounds in the studio. Hope you're joining us on your radio. But as we've seen time and time again, these policies just aren't working. So I really kind of want to switch and talk to the Portugal model, which, are you familiar with what Portugal did in the year 2001 whatsoever?
I'm going to be honest, not really.
All right, we're all learning today. So Portugal in 2001 was in a situation very similar to America in 2019. It was just, I don't remember the exact amount, but I think it was like 2 to 5% of their population was intravenous drug addicts.
Mm.
Not only heroin addicts, but like needle-using heroin mm-hmm. addicts. They had massive drug uses of almost every kind. You had, you know, like we're seeing in a lot of our cities today. You had needles in the streets, people overdosing wherever, begging for money, just going through the motions of a vicious, vicious addiction cycle. So what did Portugal do? Did they build more prisons? No. Did they hire more police? No. Did they give Jeff Sessions a call? Hell no. What they did is they decriminalized all drug use for personal amounts of drugs. I don't know the specific amounts, but essentially what they did is they said, what we're going to do when we're if we're going to target anyone, it's going to be big-time suppliers and pushers. Individuals who use will be treated with dignity. We'll get them to treatment centers for help. We're not going to ruin their lives because they have an addiction. Their addiction rate has plummeted by far more than 50% since mm-hmm. these changes started impacting in 2001. Since then, we have seen a massive, massive reduction in their spending on their drug crisis, their spending on healthcare. They've seen far better social outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
Switzerland recently has started something even crazier. Has our Students for Sensible drug policy president heard about what they do in Switzerland?
Nope.
So, yes, educating the educators.
Yep.
But what they do in Switzerland, believe it or not, if you have a heroin addiction, like a confirmed you've been using for more than 2 years, what they do is they actually give people free heroin. They give them a place to use. They have to make them prove that they're a heroin addict and that they're on blah, blah, blah. But they give them a place to do the heroin, they give them a certain quantity, and they give them safe means to do so. The result in that has been that more addicts are getting off of heroin. Overdoses have fallen to almost zero because there's a lot of research that we're learning that how you use a drug is not just the drug that you use or the quantity or the quality. It's your set and setting. It's how you're perceiving the situation. It's your environment. In Switzerland, by bringing drug use out of, you know, alleyways and bedrooms and in the clinic-like facilities, has seen a massive decrease in STDs transmitted because of dirty needles and things like that. They've seen lower crime rates because people have a place to get their heroin.
Yeah.
And is it publicly funded? Gerger, crazy libertarian? Yes, it is. But you know what? Damn it. If I have to spend money on this, which I'm going to have to, I would much rather we spend money giving people a safe place to do it or saving lives than spending thousands of dollars on ambulance rides and hospital visits and Narcan doses and not to mention beds and cells and all of that stuff that comes along with it. And so I want to kind of move on to, I mean, I think it's pretty obvious, at least to the two of us in the studio, that this system doesn't make sense, right?
Right, 100%.
And this isn't working. We're not getting what we need out of it. So why do we continue to do it? Largely because there have been specific moneyed interests in that. What's the term? The prison industrial complex?
Yeah.
So what do you make of the kind of convoluted system that has come out about drug prohibition?
It's messed up. It's just messed up. Like, so I have heard, I didn't know it was Portugal and Switzerland, but I do know what you're talking about. Like, I was aware that was going on. Not to be like, oh, what a ditz. It's just sad because at this point, you're just keeping people in for money. And are you putting a price on a life? Kind of, you are. Like, that's exactly what's going on. Is you're using, like, filling, like, cells and filling beds in prison systems. You're using people in exchange for money.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought we ended that a long time ago. You know what I mean? It's just different. I have a lot of problems. So my end-all goal, the reason I'm going into pharmacy is because I want to be a, like a federal prison pharmacist, because the healthcare in there is not good. It's just, it's not working. So then I get the question a lot of times is like, oh, well, if you want to work in a prison, don't you want to keep more inmates in? No, I don't. I want people to be free and safe and reduced in like addiction and not contained and not being used for monetary purposes. Mm-hmm. That's the whole goal of a healthcare provider. It's not for the money. It's for the quality of life people are receiving. And for a select few to profit off of so many that are being stuck, either if it's for addiction or past mistakes or some sort of social injustice, like that's, it just doesn't make sense to me. Mm-hmm. And people will give you numbers and figures and they'll be like, oh, but this is policies and they've made mistakes in the past. Well, everyone's messed up. Mm-hmm. So you're going to lock them away forever. Mm-hmm. Great. It's hard for me to wrap my head around, I'm going to be honest.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's the, growing consensus. Mm-hmm. And I've said it once, I've said it 100 billion times on this show already. We really need to bring back a culture of questioning authority in this mm-hmm. country. We need to bring back, we've gotten way too good at the what in our policy over the last 20 years. We've gotten horrible at the why. With our, you know, war on drugs, with our over-incarceration problem, with our policies in the Middle East, and all the other things that you folks tune in to hear me complain about, it just seems like we've gotten far, far, far too good at letting our leaders off. Now, I want to talk a little bit. I know, obviously, you're a pharmacy student. You're in the research realm. Mm-hmm. You want to talk about some of the promising new stuff that we're seeing come out with psilocybin and things like MDMA, potentially LSD.
I would. So there's a lot of exciting things that go on every day in the pharmacy world, either if it's like prescription-based, which obviously it is. There's not a ton of research that can be done on illicit drugs, if you want to call them that, because of the criminalization. Like, you just really can't unless you want to get thrown in too. But especially with psilocybin, so like getting mushrooms, like for end of life care. So for those that maybe have a disease, like it's chronic, it's going to be fatal. They're in hospice. You get like, everyone's scared to die. Like even if you say you're not, I feel like you are, mm-hmm. personal opinion, but you can use psilocybin to help alleviate that pain and that anxiety and the fear of what's going to happen next. The long-term effects obviously aren't super known because it's for end-of-life care, but in the research that like I've seen and that we've kind of looked into together as well, it seems very promising, and it's really exciting. We've seen, I mean, look at all the states that maybe not recreational marijuana, but at least medicinal marijuana. Like, think about that in the 70s. Do you think that would have gone down? No. Mm-hmm. But with people starting to open their minds and questioning, like, what else can we do with this? I mean, if you look at back in the Wild West, there was cough syrups, and we learned about this in school. There was a cough syrup that had hydromorphone, I think it had chloroform, and it had meth in it. And that's going to stop your cough.
Won't be worried
quick.
About the cough for a little bit,
not
though.
Not at all, no. And it's like, things change and progress so much, but by not being able to ask yourself, like, what else can this do? How can this help? You're going to just start regressing like we are right now.
Mm-hmm.
Having all these laws and policies, like, and I can understand where people are concerned about the use of it, but being able to study it and look further into the other possibilities, you can expand healthcare so much more. So I'm going to go off on a tangent. This is my, not my specialty, but my passion.
Go off.
There's something called pharmacogenomics. And basically, it's a newer field in healthcare in terms of, you know, like diabetes studies and stuff like that. So pharmacogenomics is the study of how different drugs work with different people based on their genetic makeup. So let's look at it in terms of like anxiety, because, I mean, I feel like that's something a lot of people can, either you know someone or you have it yourself. It's very common. So with anxiety, there's different genes that interact with certain drugs that you'll have. And these genes, they code for something like enzymes. And these mm-hmm. enzymes are going to be used in your body to help the drug basically get it so it's active and it's ready to go.
Okay.
those genes are different for everyone. Like you and I, we look very different. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason for that. But besides that, our bodies work very differently. So as far as anxiety meds, like you can try 4 different meds and they might not all work for you based on your genetic makeup that you've inherited. And then at that point, sometimes prescribers are like, oh, that sucks. Like, I'm sorry. We can't do anything. Maybe, you know, write more, exercise more, have more friends. Like the things you've been told since you were little, basically.
Super easy things to do when you're battling a mental health condition, by the way.
100%. Yeah. It's easy to get on that health routine. Exactly what you want to do. Yeah. But then if you look at like how like marijuana, for instance, like it's a calm, like it calms you down. Especially like the CBD part and like THC, you know, it depends. Mm-hmm. We can get into discussion about that, but like that might work for someone when prescription drugs don't, mm-hmm. but we're not giving them a chance for that.
So we're effectively we're allowing government regulators to effectively limit the toolbox that doctors and pharmacists are allowed to use?
In my personal opinion, I would say yes. I would say there's so much more research that could be done. And there's so much time that has been lost due to the policies we have in place that I personally feel like we could expand our toolbox. We could work more on an individual-based dosing regimen for people. And with genetic testing becoming even more prominent in our community, you can definitely see what's going to work best because everyone's different, but everyone deserves a fighting chance.
Mm-hmm. And that's what we love to talk about on here. The fact that everyone's an individual, mm-hmm. and really this is something that you'd think that everyone could agree on, but especially for those who have already been through the ringer, mm-hmm. you know what I mean, with treatment-resistant depression, PTSD, whatever else, you know, I mean, if we're talking even less controversial stuff like seizures for things like medical marijuana, why has the government got to make it harder on people? If it's gonna do anything, shouldn't these be the people that have the most access to what might alleviate them?
Absolutely. And then you hear the conversation of, well, that's a reason why some states have like medicinal marijuana. Great, but how are you gonna get it?
Mm-hmm.
I was just speaking with someone a couple weeks ago, and they were unable to obtain. It's not really a prescription. It's more of like, oh yeah, this
could help. It's a weird.
It's like
gray
an allowance
area.
In a way
because the federal government has put so many gates up.
But this particular individual was unable to obtain their medical marijuana because the prescribers were scared to sign off that they had a legit medical reason for it. Now the prescribers in this stance, they're not saying, oh yeah, go and take this. They just have to sign off and say, yes, you have this like disease state, or yes, you have this infliction. You would be able to try this, but we're not telling you you have to. They couldn't even get that because prescribers were scared, which honestly is understandable. You go to school for how long? You pay so much money in, and then, you know, one time you write off, and then the federal government is like, oh, no, you can't do that. We're going to take away all of your clinical-based knowledge and not allow you to practice.
Just.
So on both sides of it, I can see where they're coming from of why a prescriber wouldn't want to, you know, give this.
Why stick your neck out?
Yeah, absolutely.
Why risk everything that you've done? I mean, it's gotten to a really sad point with our drug policy where prescribers are having to pick whether they want to continue to stay in business and provide for their families and do the things that, you know, you take a great deal of pride in your work. All mm-hmm. of these people work. I was a political science student for a reason. There's no way I could do some of these programs. And then the federal government is effectively forcing them to choose to violate their Hippocratic Oath.
Yeah.
Or to stay in business. And boy, that is not...
It's very gray.
Yeah. I certainly don't want my tax dollars to be subsidizing that gray area.
Yeah.
And we look at it, you know, not only has this prohibition failed to actually reduce drugs, not only has it failed to make us safer or healthier, not only has it failed to do any of the things that it said it was going to do, not only has it led to generations of people, inner city communities being destroyed, horrible offenses to our Fourth Amendment rights, all of this stuff. The government is literally telling those who are chronically ill, on death's door at some points, what they can and can't try. I want to sort of... it seems like a good time to bring in a reference from, there's a gentleman named Matt Kibbe, extraordinarily great free market libertarian whatever writer, and he told the story of back in the 2000s, he was diagnosed with cancer in his mid-30s, and most of the conventional treatments weren't working, the cancer was spreading, and he attempted to go get some advanced and relatively untested medicine done on him because he was desperate and, you know, presumably like the rest of us, wants to live a long and happy life, and the government told him no. So he tells a really fantastic story, I'm sure it's on YouTube somewhere, about how he had his, in his words, the whitest friend that he had, go to DC to try and squirm weed to try and help. But it is just sad that we live in a country where that's a reality for many Americans. Mm-hmm. It's sad when the black market is a place of healthcare, and when things like internet forums, Arrowhead.org, for example, are coming to be more reliable places for these people to get their afflictions fixed. No matter if you are a crazy libertarian or you're much less crazy drug policy reformer, or just a concerned citizen, someone who wants to stop spending so much damn money on stuff that doesn't work, we can see that we need to start looking for alternatives. And what's that come down to? And we're not even saying we're right, right? We're just saying, let's start questioning what we're told and looking for alternatives, because we're losing more people to a year from overdoses than we did in the entire Vietnam War. We have a very serious problem. I want to thank my guest.
Taylor Bengtson. Taylor Bengtson. Oh, sorry.
President of Students for Sensible Drug Policy at North Dakota State University, for coming on. I am your always crazy, always original crazy libertarian, Bradley Foster. I'll be back in a little bit. This is the Crazy Libertarian. I think that's kind of where I want to leave it off on, is I really want you all to just think a little more critically. And so if that sounds like something that you'd be interested in, I encourage you to tune in each and every Wednesday morning. This has been Bradley with the Crazy Libertarian. You know, I'm going to end the show, as I will every week, something else to check out, with a song. And it's not going to be your typical poppy, what you listen to work to in the morning, so I apologize for that if that's an inconvenience. But I want to bring up one of my personal heroes and someone that a lot of, I feel, my listening audience can identify with, the man in black himself, Johnny Cash. Now, I've been talking a lot about critical thinking and questioning authority, and it made me think of this particular cut of this song. Johnny Cash was invited to the White House by none other than the devil himself, Richard Nixon, and was asked to perform. Nixon requested two songs, one of which was a song called Welfare Cadillac, which was extremely disparaging to the lower class. Talked about a man who was poor as hell, but always had the money from his welfare check to pay for his Cadillac. Johnny Cash, without announcing what songs he was going to be playing, went up and, instead of singing Welfare Cadillac, sang this monumental tune, What Is Truth, in which he really went up to at the time, the face of corruption, power, cronyism, dirty politics in our country, and laid them bare for the entire nation to hear. So with that, I leave you with Johnny Cash, What Is Truth.
We'll go ahead and do it now for you while we're on our thoughts are running in that direction about today. I know our president is as concerned about the problem of drugs in this country as most any other problem we could have, because it's a raging problem. Of course, I guess I might be qualified to say a word or two about drugs, having been up one of those crooked roads a time or two. But, you know, in order to say something to somebody that might be meaningful, you got to kind of get them on your side. So I had these words, a poem that I wrote to the youth of America. It was a 12-verse poem. We took 4 verses of it and made a recording out of it. It's on their side, which was the way I was feeling at the time. Maybe I was trying to be a kid again. And the lonely voice of youth cries, what is truth? The old man turned off the radio, said, where did all of the old songs go? Kids sure play funny music these days, play it in the strangest ways. He said, it looks to me like they've all gone wild. It was peaceful back when I was a child. Man, could it be that the girls and boys are trying to be heard above your noise? And the lonely voice of youth cries, what is truth? Little boy of three sitting on the floor looks up and says, Daddy, what is war? Son, that's when people fight and die. Little boy of three says, Daddy, why? Young man of 17 in Sunday school, being taught the golden rule. By the time another year's gone around, maybe his turn to lay his life down. So can you blame the voice of youth for asking, what is truth? Young man sitting on a witness stand, man with a book says, raise your hand. Repeat after me, I solemnly swear. Man looks down at his long hair. And although the young man solemnly swore, nobody seemed to hear anymore. So it didn't really matter if the truth was there. It was the cut of his clothes and the length of his hair. And the lonely voice of youth cries, what is truth? Young girl dancing to the latest beat, found new ways to move her feet. A young man speaking in a city square might be trying to say that he really cares. The other ones that you're calling wild, gonna be the leaders in a little while. This old world's waking to a newborn day, and I solemnly swear that it'll be their way. We better help that voice of youth find what is truth. And the lonely voice of youth cries, what is truth?
Hey folks, thank you so much for tuning in. I hope that you enjoyed that song. Once again, this has been Bradley Foster. You have been on the Crazy Libertarian at 88.1 FM, proudly serving the Fargo-Moorhead area. You have a great rest of your day. See you next week.